Welcome back to the Over the Monster podcast, Dead Zone of the Winter Edition. I am Brian Joyner here with Over the Monster site manager, Dan Secatore. Dan, how are you?
Brian, I'm doing good. For the second week in a row, I'm recording a podcast while some beautiful atmospheric snow is falling out the window. Not sticking again, because we haven't really had any snow stick except for like an inch last week. But it's, you know, I'm always of the opinion that if you're going to live in a cold place in the winter, you might as well get snow. If you don't have to drive and if you don't have to shovel, and I live in a urban enough environment where I don't have to drive if I don't need to, and I have a tiny little driveway, then like, what's the downside of snow? That's my take.
I agree with you, and I'm jealous because once again, just a few hundred miles to the southwest, we have what would appear to be a dreary mid-November day. No snow.
Have you guys had any snow yet?
In January, on Saturday, we had an hour or so of heavy flurries. That is all we've had in January, and we had one, like, three, four-inch snowstorm in December, but that's it.
Yeah, we're getting robbed here. Because you know what sucks about this, too, actually? It's not just that we're being robbed of a winter, but this mediocre winter steals some of the drama of spring as well. You know, like when we have random 60 degrees in days in January, like when they eventually come somewhat consistently in March, like you don't care as much about them. You're not as excited.
Well, the only reason I'm inclined to disagree is that the new weather patterns that have emerged in the last few years have seen, especially New York, these tremendous March snowstorms. And it doesn't seem like it'll happen again, and then it just happens again because, oh, it's March. It's not going to happen. It just keeps happening. So it's like we get, especially here, more so than there where it's colder, we get like 5 months of dreary fall and then winter packed into one very oddly placed section of March. Then the spring starts and it's a little disappointing for the same reason you say, but because the days are colder than they were 2 months ago, inexplicably. So this is, but again, this is the dead zone. And that's why today's podcast is not going to stick to the Red Sox, but we will start with the Red Sox. We'll start with the website to be specific. Dan, what's
little housekeeping at the top
on the website?
All right. Well, just to keep you updated. So you call this the dead zone, but the Red Sox have actually signed three players this week,
which I was going to get to that.
So other than the winter meetings, this has maybe been the most active week. So we got some good stuff for the new signings, which we'll get into in the pod: Adam Duvall, Jorge Alfaro, and Raymel Tapia. We've got Meet the New Guy articles for all those guys up. If you want to read a little bit about those guys. And then this morning on Friday, depending on when you're listening to this, we've got a new headline article from our friend Fitzy Mopena, the delightful Twitter account of Red Sox first baseman Tristan Casas. Brian, have you experienced Tristan Casas's Twitter feed yet?
No, I've seen this and I plan to read the article, but I do want to note that I remembered that in addition to Mrs. Secatore and Mr. Joyner, Mr. Casas's birthday is also January 15th.
Was it really? I missed that. Oh, my goodness. All right. Yeah, you should check out both the article and then you should. If you read the article, you don't then need to go into his Twitter feed because Fitzy combed through like 10 years worth of tweets for the purpose of this. But suffice it to say, if Casas is any good at all indications that we saw from last year are that he's going to be, he is going to be a massive, massive fan favorite in Boston. He really, really is. He just seems like a real dude, you know, he really does. And he's not afraid to try and be funny. He's not afraid to try and be cocky. on there. I'm pretty excited. Where does Casas rank in the things you're most excited about for the 2023 Red Sox? Which is probably something we should have a podcast about. So maybe we shouldn't step on the toes, but
no, we can do that next week. But I would say that I'm trying to keep my expectations in line, but when I saw him just throttling balls, his swing just reminds me of...
You're talking about the shirtless swings that he posted on Twitter?
Just the swing. Just okay. The swing in general just reminds me of, and this is not damning with faint praise, it reminds me of good Cody Bellinger. It just... The absolute roundhouse... unbelievable harnessing of power. From the left side, just breathtaking to watch. And I trying to keep my expectations in line, but combined with his apparent having a personality, which for a baseball player can be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Having an interesting personality. Yeah, I'm trying not to get excited, and that is not something you hear from me very often.
One other thing to note, and maybe this is why he has a personality, and it also just is something that makes him a little bit more fun. There's a picture that you may have seen floating around Twitter of a young Little League-aged Tristan Casas. If you haven't seen it, I think if you go on the Pod and Lansdowne account, they recently just tweeted it for some reason or another.
He's lost a lot of weight since then.
That's what I was gonna say. He was a chubby little kid. There's a picture of him. He's in a Little League jersey. I think he's playing for the Sugar Canes. He's holding up a couple of trophies. And yeah, Tristan Casas was the fat little kid on the Little League team, it looks like. Which is even more delightful.
The big humans often started out as big little humans.
As big little they humans, yeah.
The bigness change.
Yeah, and maybe that's why he has a personality. You know, there's theories that are always floating around about how it's very rare to see a beautiful comedian because beautiful people don't need to develop the humor skills to attract people. So maybe Tristan Casas has a personality because he wasn't always this chiseled monster slugger.
I see it. I could totally see that. He has some new teammates.
He does indeed.
To your point about me calling this dead zone while the Red Sox have made so many moves, this Chaim Bloom moves in silence. Real G's move in silence like lasagna, per Lil Wayne. This is Chaim Bloom's time. It's because it's the dead zone.
Yeah, and all the big names off the board.
The clearance. The clearance sign is out. This is Spirit Halloween on November 3rd.
He's finding the things that were like knocked off the rack. And are wedged in
and
between
50% off, 50% off until it closes. He is just buying up the displays, wrong price tag on it, all that stuff. This is his time to shine, and shine he has.
So you're excited about this week, huh?
No.
All right.
Second I realized Adam Duvall was available, I figured the Red Sox were going to sign him. This was.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I guess we should start with Duvall because that's the biggest name here. This Adam Duvall thing could go one of two ways. Or, I mean, there's always a middle way too, but we have to be entertaining on a podcast. So we're going to say it's one of two ways and no other possible scenarios. Best case scenario. No, I'm sure you've seen as soon as the signing was announced, even before the signing was announced, when the rumors started flying, you know, people start putting his spray chart over Fenway Park. Adam Duvall is a right-handed masher. And it's possible that this guy is a perfect fit for Fenway Park and hits 30, 35 home runs. It really is. I mean, he's not that far off from doing that in his career. And defensively, I mean, with Kike in short, he's easily the best outfielder the Red Sox have right now. And that's not necessarily damning with faint praise. Like, he is a legitimately good outfielder. And it looks like, I mean, he's barely played center field in his career. But he has done it. You know, down the stretch in the postseason for the Braves in 2021, he was their starting center fielder. He was usually moved to one of the corners late in the games for defensive purposes, but you know, he was good enough to be the starting center fielder on the World Series champs in 2021. And he started last season, playing most of the Braves innings in center field, and he graded out fine. He graded out perfectly fine. He was, I think he played 40 something innings or games in center, and he recorded four outs above average, which obviously, so outs above average, that's four outs better than league average of zero. And he only did that in 40 games. So if you want to extrapolate that to a full season, to an extra 120, 130 games, if he's giving you 12 outs above average as a center fielder, Trent Grisham, who led the league last year, only had 17. So you're actually looking at like a potential above average center fielder out there. So if it hits that best case scenario of 30, 35 home runs and above average center field defense, Adam, like this legitimately has a chance to be the single best pickup of the offseason. It really does. Like, people will talk about it that way. On the other hand, what Red Sox fans aren't really talking about right now is that he is coming off wrist surgery. And, you know, any Red Sox fans, certainly Red Sox fans of our age, when they hear about a wrist injury to a hitter.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
Okay, I won't.
Don't say it.
Okay, I won't. But no, so I may put a piece on this on the site soon. I've been trying to find other hitters who've had this wrist injury. So what happened? He crashed into the outfield wall chasing after a foul ball last year. And the actual injury was like a torn wrist sheath or something like that, which David Ortiz, I think, had at one point. David Ortiz did not need surgery for it, though. But three people who did need surgery for it were Mark Teixeira, Jose Bautista, and Nick Johnson. Those are only three guys that I can come up with right now. In all three cases, I looked at it, all three of them were kind of slow to return the next season, you know, both getting on the field and then getting their power stroke back. And all three guys lost like around 30 points in their slugging percentage the next season. And Adam Duvall doesn't walk at all. Adam Duvall barely makes contact and strikes out a ton. And Adam Duvall, who loses power, is a guy who has no major league value. He really is, despite the defense. Because the only things he brings to the table right now at this point in his career, and frankly for his entire career, are solid to above average outfield defense and power. If he doesn't have power, he doesn't have a place in this team. So there's a scenario where this pickup is a complete and total disaster.
Well, I think that scenario is why they were able to get him at the price they got him for. And this is the standard operating procedure of Bloom and Company. And look, we've talked about the catcher situation, but it's just good roster building because Reese McGuire can help him strengthen that wrist. He can really teach him how to get the wrist nice.
Does that strengthen the wrist, or is that, I think, I don't know. That might be a tendonitis. Oh,
like, yeah, risk. Like, you don't know. Right. It's very Bloom doctrine in a way that I like. And I believe, I mean, I can't argue with the stats you said about people losing the power, but
They didn't lose it permanently. I should note, like Teixeira, after he got that injury, he had a bad year in his first year rebounding from that, and then rebounded fine the next year and was out of the baseball the year after that. But rebounded fine for Jose Bautista, the same thing. Like, Bautista still had a couple of excellent vintage Jose Bautista years after that surgery. They just weren't the first year after that surgery, which, you know, Duvall's only on a 1 year deal. So
he's only on a 1 year deal, but I have to imagine that this is a play for the following season as well. At least laying the ground, like, because look, if he starts slow, comes on a little stronger, then maybe there's not a ton of interest from other teams, but the Red Sox are like, okay. And also Adam,
we know where he's going. Yeah.
We signed you, like, maybe it's a long-term play. Maybe it's a total short-term play also. What if he starts out really hot and the Red Sox aren't in it? Flip him.
Right.
Easily. Yeah.
And so, he could be. I mean, I should. So, you know, if you look at his numbers last year, he had an absolutely brutal start to the year. I mean, he was awful for the first 2 months. And then in the last month before he hurt his wrist, let's see, I have him here. All right. So the last 34 games he played last year, he slashed 255, 317, 618 with 10 home runs. The last 34 games he played before he hurt his wrist last year.
Well, I have great news for you. If you're using second half splits last year, Justin Turner is going to look mighty fine.
Yeah, that's true. No, this look right now, I mean, this Red Sox offense actually has a chance to be really, really good.
This is what Bloom does to you.
You're right. I neglected to mention it in the site admin. I forgot about it, but you wrote about Yoshida this week. You wrote about the Steamer projections. They had him at.
And more importantly, I wrote about the article where people were trashing him, which I felt was so egregious. Given, especially, we're dealing with an unknown here. We're dealing with people known to collude over these things. The actual dollar amount they gave him versus what they were projecting, the percentage-wise was high, but the actual payout is not, in baseball terms, very much.
No, it's true. The players who come over from Japan and Korea always come over at a discount. Always.
Like Kode Senga, if he does half of what the people in my dynasty baseball league apparently think he's going to do, he'll be worth twice what the Mets signed him for.
Oh yeah, for sure. And same thing Yoshida. So just to put the actual Steamer numbers out there. So Steamer is projecting him to have a 388 on base percentage, which would have been the sixth best in all of baseball last year. They're projecting him to have a 372 weighted on base percentage, which would have been 12th best and would basically identical with one Rafael Devers. They're predicting 19 home runs for him and WRC plus, you know, but according to some people, the single best offensive stat there is, they're giving him a 140, which would have been 18th in all of baseball last year, tied with Carlos Correa.
They're projecting him to walk in and be Michael Brantley, and that's a compliment.
Yeah. And for, you know, for the things I'll say this too about his, you know, everyone, he is not coming over with a very sterling defensive reputation. But I will say, and look, we have, for as little as we know about Masataka Yoshida's bat, we obviously know nothing about his glove. I did read one scouting report, and this was a scouting report from a Japanese source, not a major league source, that said that his biggest weakness defensively is going back. So if you put him in front of the monster for 81 games a year, you kind of are maybe, you know, eliminating his biggest weakness and optimizing his defense.
If Manny can do it, he can do it.
If Manny can do it, he can do it. Yeah. So this, I mean, look, this lineup, if you take the best case scenario of Duvall, if you take the best case scenario of Yoshida, if Devers continues to be Devers, if Casas adjusts nicely, is this all of a sudden like a really good lineup? Because they weren't bad last year. The problem with last year's team was the pitching. The Red Sox were up towards the top of the league in many, many offensive categories last year. I think they led the league in doubles. They were up near the top in slugging. I think they were one or two in on-base percentage. And obviously you take Xander Bogaerts. Xander Bogaerts was the most productive hitter on the Red Sox by a significant chunk last year. You're taking him out. But if Yoshida puts up those numbers, he's pretty close to matching what you get from Xander. And if you are replacing Bobby Dalbec and Franchi Cordero with Tristan Casas and he flourishes, and if Kike Hernandez is replacing Jaron Duran, or I guess now Adam Duvall is replacing Jaron Duran, Maybe the offense is better to significantly better next year.
And I want to be fair to Bloom because I've been hard on Bloom for a long time. No matter what happens with Yoshida, I think it's a great contract. If for whatever reason he can't hack it, it's worth the bet. But I strongly do not believe that's going to happen.
I do want to say one thing since you just said worth the contract and a bet. So I tweeted out yesterday about, or it was 2 days ago, about the Duvall signing and basically laying out what I just said, that like this either could be an outstanding pickup or it could be a total disaster. And, you know, I immediately got responses saying, well, you know, that's, hey, it's a low risk move, 1 year for $7 million. And that is, of course, what 99% of all baseball fans would say. Like, who cares if he's bad? He only costs $7 million. And again, not to beat a dead horse with what I've talked about before, about the language and how we talk about contracts and risk and how fans view players. But whatever, might as well play the hits. It's sort of interesting that when we say something is low risk, what we're saying is, well, Adam Duvall could be bad, but it's low risk because it doesn't cost anything. When in reality, and that's true, but another way to look at it is there are only 9 positions on the field and you're counting on him to play one of them. Adam Duvall could be bad, with the result being that one, our center fielder is awful and the team sucks as a result. That seems pretty risky to me too. But we don't view, for like, fans don't view the risk side of any given transaction of, oh, this guy could be bad. It's only risky if he's bad and expensive.
But that's because the Red Sox shop in bulk for this type of player.
That's true. But I think I think it's even bigger. This is like a hobby horse of mine, of how I hate the way that modern fandom works, where we're so concerned about the bottom line, right? So like, if Adam Duvall is bad, oh, well, it doesn't cost the Red Sox anything. Instead of, if Adam Duvall is bad, oh shit, we planned on him being one of our 9 everyday starters and we messed up and their team is worse as a result.
I think that's implied. I mean, last year is when that shit happened. It's just that the experiment just didn't produce enough to, especially in the rotation, to keep the team afloat or even competitive. Mm. So I don't necessarily, I agree with what you were saying, but the Red Sox approach is so the polar opposite of it, where they're going to try to mitigate the risk by having 5 guys with a 30% chance of breaking through, and then
I don't know necessarily if that.
I don't know if those
5 guys in the infield. Like, is Raymel Tapia one of them? You want to move to the Raymel Tapia signing?
I don't want to, but it is on the agenda. I have no interest in talking about either of these guys.
I do actually have a big interest in talking about Jorge Alfaro because I think Jorge Alfaro, I am convinced, is going to come north with the Red Sox this spring training. We're going to start this season with the Reese McGuire, Jorge Alfaro catching tandem. Connor Wong is going to go back to Worcester. I'm completely convinced of it. Jorge Alfaro, I mean, you can make a case that he's the best of the 3 catching options that the Red Sox have right now. This guy, I mean, he is a monster bat, an absolutely monster bat. His exit velocity is like above 90th percentile. He's also, with Trevor Story out, he might legitimately be the fastest player in the Red Sox. If Raymel Tapia starts the year in the minors, and I don't see a place for him in the major league roster right now, so that seems most likely, Jorge Alfaro may legitimately be the fastest player in the Red Sox with the biggest power bat, and he has an absolute cannon of an arm. He's not a great receiver, but he has an absolute cannon of an arm. Like, this guy is a toolsy, tantalizing guy. And obviously he fits perfectly to platoon against lefties for Reese McGuire. So I think it's more likely than not that he ends up as one of the two primary catching options to start the year, not Connor Wong. And I think if that happens, I think like he's going to be a massive fan favorite. This is a fun player. He's a fun player to watch. He's faster
than Jaren Duran.
Well, okay, fair enough. Yes, he's not faster than Jaren Duran. I shouldn't have said that. Well, I don't expect Jaren Duran to come north with the Red Sox either.
That was the other question.
Yes, I don't expect. No, you're fair. Yes, okay. He is not faster than Jaren Duran, but he is faster than just about anyone else on the team, maybe bar Story, who won't be in the picture. So he's toolsy as hell. He's fun as hell. He plays with flair. He's got an attitude. I think he had 4 walk-off hits for the Padres last year, which obviously that's not going to carry over. But still, you know, that's a fun guy. He just won the MVP of the Dominican Winter Series, the championship series. So I'm assuming Caribbean Series will be starting in a week or two. You can catch that on probably on MLB TV. They used to put it on MLB Network. I don't know why they stopped doing that. But you can definitely stream it. I'm excited for him. I think he could be the most popular backup catcher in Boston since Doug Mirabelli. I'll say that.
All that checks out except for me having to be excited about it.
Come on.
It's fine. I would say that I believe everything you say. And I take it all at face value. However, if you were to look at his slash line, it is not what you'd expect after hearing your spiel.
But no, he's a catcher,
and there's way more. There's a catcher, and that is the one position where that arm is gonna come in very handy.
Well, yes.
For the Red Sox, especially for the Red Sox.
I mean, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, but this is also something that maybe makes him a fun player to watch. Like, he is a crazy, crazy free swinger. And he's not necessarily great at making contact, which is probably ultimately going to be frustrating. But, you know, I think isn't it kind of fun to watch those guys hit? Don't you kind of enjoy? I mean, look, I love a professional at bat as much as the next guy. But, you know, 6-7 pitch at bats that result in a ground ball to second base, or even if they result in a walk, you know, that's an okay thing to watch. But when you get up there and you watch a guy that's just like, well, this guy's going to swing at 3 straight pitches no matter where they are, it's a little bit more exciting as a viewer, is it not?
Unless you really need them to not strike out.
Yeah.
But your point is taken that he's worth noting, but
and one other thing too. So
I also agree he's definitely gonna. I think him in the McGuire platoon makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And one other thing that we keep forgetting about, or it's not that anyone's forgotten about it, but I don't think nobody's talking about it enough. I don't think we're talking about how drastic these rule changes are going to be next year.
I keep forgetting that they exist.
Exactly. Everyone keeps forgetting. Last year, Jorge Alfaro had the second strongest throwing arm of any catcher in baseball. And commensurate with that, the second fastest pop time. So on bases are going to become a major part of the game next year. A major part of the game. And so stopping stolen bases is going to be important next year. And he's got a much better chance of doing that than Reese McGuire and Connor Wong. And you know, for that matter, maybe we should talk about Raimel Tapia a little bit here. Raimel Tapia is also a speed guy. I mean, he's not like Jaren Duran level, but he once stole 20 bases in a year and only got caught 6 times. Now, Raimel Tapia has no power at all, no power whatsoever. But depending on how drastic these pickoff rules are, right? So in the new pickoff rule, a pitcher can only throw over twice now. And if they throw over a third or fourth time and don't record an out, it's a balk. And on top of that, the bases are bigger, meaning the base paths are shorter. So there's a whole potential class of speed guys in baseball right now who, if they get on first, they're stealing every time. Every time. And so a player like Raimel Tapia, all of a sudden, Raimel Tapia is an excellent contact hitter. Excellent contact hitter. Almost never strikes out, has great bat-to-ball skills, but he has no power. But if he can start turning in all of, turning all of his singles into automatic doubles, because he just, you know, dinks some balls out to right field and then immediately steals second, Raimel Tapia is all of a sudden a way more valuable player than he's ever been in his career.
I mean, Chaim Bloom is not stupid.
Yeah, we'll see.
But I mean, that what you're saying makes total sense. There's an unknown, they're not usually unknowns this big in terms of how the game is going to be played that we know about. It's not like Rob Manfred being like, we're going to choose the balls.
Yeah, right.
No, this is like the NFL where they eliminated hitting over the middle. So teams went to these huge passing attacks and linebackers got smaller to follow the passing attacks. But then the whole league got smaller and the Patriots and other teams immediately went big again.
And so this is just
planning. This is something you don't, you know, the NFL changes rules all the time. So the personnel gets shifted in those directions and you don't see it with baseball quite like this. You see it when there's a big home run type explosion, then guys like Duvall would be way more popular.
Yeah.
This is
now all of a sudden getting on first base going forward is going to be much, much more important going forward than it has been. And obviously getting on first base is always the most important thing in baseball. But whereas, you know, for the past 20 years where power has been emphasized so much and contact has been de-emphasized as a result. Now, if you have the slightest bit of speed and you can get on first base, like you're trouble for the opposing team. Guys like Raimel Tapia are all of a sudden going to be in the category of like the Ricky Henderson types where it's like you're in scoring position if you're on first. That's going to filter down to guys like Raimel Tapia, guys who are fast but not, you know, super elite runners.
Do not ever mention Raimel Tapia and Ricky Henderson in the same sentence again.
Fair enough. They're left fielders. What else? Okay, that's it. Yeah, that's the only thing they have in common.
All right, that's probably a wrap on the roster moves. We're going to get into a fun segment. We don't know what we're going to talk about or how long it's going to go or where it's going to go. Before that, we're going to take an ad break. Maybe they're ads, maybe they're not. We'll be back in a second. And we're back. We didn't actually go anywhere. There might have been ads, and if so, they will have been in that break. Dan and I have decided that there's not enough Red Sox stuff to talk about. And recently, I expressed my admiration for a novel entitled Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders, which should be noted, won the Man Booker Prize for the best English language novel in the world the year it was released.
I didn't think we were actually going to talk about this.
We're not, but I'm just saying.
Is this your topic?
Dan, then got all literary on me and said that I was basically a sellout for reading Saunders's books.
Not that you were a sellout, it's more that you were basic.
Okay, precisely. Precisely. Yeah. To which, in this case, absolutely. Dan said, let's do a whole podcast on that. We're not doing that. That's all the Lincoln and the Bardo talk you're getting, almost certainly.
Is it? All right, real brief. George Saunders is a genius and essentially a secular saint. He has spent most of his career as a lesser known name amongst the big name fiction authors. And that's a direct result of Lincoln and the Bardo was his first novel. Prior to that, he spent 20 years just writing short stories, which aren't as commercially profitable. Lincoln and the Bardo is good. It's fine. But his short stories are absolutely revolutionary. He's hilarious. He is absolutely like laugh out loud, you know, spit out whatever you're drinking hilarious. This guy could in another life could have been on SNL. He's been a frequent guest of Colbert. Colbert loves him. So he's been on Colbert's show for years, including going back to the Colbert Report on Comedy Central. So he is hilarious. But what he was particularly genius about was that he invented a new narrative style, but he took free direct in-course into a completely new direction. And his absolute best fiction, most of which, in my opinion, is in 10th of December, utilizes a third person narrator, but one in which you are in that person's head. I won't say you're more in that person's head than ever before, because obviously there's Joyce and Ulysses, and that was done 100 years ago. But it's more that you're in their head and in their language more than any other narrator you've ever experienced. And he absolutely mastered that device. It's all over 10th of December. No other writer can do it. And it's just fucking fascinating when you read it. And Lincoln and the Bardo just doesn't have any of that. He completely went in another direction with Lincoln and the Bardo. And it's good, but it's something else entirely different.
Yeah, it's like the most beautiful and empathetic book that also makes you laugh out loud that you've ever read. But sure, who wants that?
Sure.
10th of December is at the ex-wife's house. I'll grab it next time I'm there.
All right,
but we decided on. We're just going to talk about whatever. If you want to hear Red Sox talk, maybe we'll sprinkle it in. Maybe
my topic for this actually is going to tie into the Red Sox. I will promise that. And it's in order to ease people in, it's sports related that will eventually tie into the Sox.
Well, why don't you go ahead? I sort of have a sports related idea, but I'm sort of just ready to go.
So I'm going to tell you a little bit, Brian Joyner, about the single biggest clown show in all of global professional sports today, which is my beloved Everton Football Club. I've talked to you about some. I think by the time we're done with this podcast, I think I'm going to force you into being a soccer fan.
I've been a soccer fan at times, but I also just want to point out when I called you a hipster for your Saunders thing, now you're an Everton fan? Okay, sure.
Okay, fair enough. Everton are sort of the hipster pick. And this story will explain why a little bit. So last year, Everton finished 16th. In the Premier League. There are only 20 teams in the Premier League. So 16th is really, really bad. But despite that, last season and the last 3 months of the season in particular were, I say this completely seriously, one of the absolute most thrilling fan experiences of my life. Right up there with the 2004 ALCS. Right up there with the Celtics championship, right up there with when my college basketball team went undefeated in conference play and rose to the number 6 national ranking.
Yeah. What college team was that, by the way?
George Washington. We were sick when I was there. We made the tournament 3 years in a row when I was a student there. Like, we were the number 6th ranked team in the country. When we were juniors, we were so goddamn good. The program has completely fallen apart since I left.
Just one quick follow-up question. What is George like?
What is George like? Stoic? Yeah. Tall?
Yeah, okay.
Good drinker?
He, just as an aside to an aside, if you ever see a bust of him and look at Liam Neeson, Liam Neeson needs to play that guy in a movie.
You think
he's also big. He's like, the casting is perfect.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen John Adams though, right?
Yes.
So I feel like the casting choices in John Adams were so perfect for everybody that I don't think I can ever see another fictional representation of the Founding Fathers. I really can't. Like Stephen Delane as Thomas Jefferson. I mean, that was fucking perfect.
David Morse was good at being understated, but I'd take Liam Neeson would be a different class of star. But if you were going to make a Washington biopic right now, that'd be my choice.
Yeah. I suppose he wouldn't be bad. Tom Wilkinson as Ben Franklin too. Like, my God, like I now picture Ben Franklin as Tom Wilkinson. Like, he was fucking perfect for that.
Wilkinson don't miss, baby.
What were we talking about? Everton. All right. So Like I said, so they finished in 16th place last year, and it was absolutely one of the most thrilling fan experiences of my life because of European football's promotion and relegation system. Had they finished 18th, they would have been knocked out of the Premier League. Now, that's a really big deal, and that's a really bad thing to happen for any team. But it actually would have been particularly horrible for Everton for a number of reasons. So whenever you see one of the 1,500 columns that online that compare English Premier League teams to American sports teams, Everton are always, always, always called the Mets, which is why they're the hipster pick. You know, they're a popular team, but they are very much clearly the second fiddle in their own city to a much bigger team. And that's a very accurate comparison, except here's the thing. Until 1990, Everton weren't the Mets. Everton were the Los Angeles Dodgers. They were an absolute behemoth. They were rich. They still are rich. They had massive support, and they were incredibly successful. They built the first purpose-built soccer stadium in England. They had, you know, the Dixie Dean, the sort of the Babe Ruth figure of English soccer, who's got these sort of completely unassailable records because the game has changed so much when he set them. He was an Everton player. They won European trophies. They won the league. They were giants of the game. And since 1990, everything's sort of been completely falling apart to them. But the one thing that Everton still had was that they are currently the record holders for the most years spent in the top flight of English soccer, and the most years consecutively. They have been in the top flight of English soccer, which is now called the Premier League, but it wasn't always called that. They've been in it for more consecutive years than Manchester United, more than Chelsea, more than Liverpool. They've been there. So this was the last thing that Everton was clinging to, and Everton fans have basically spent the last 30 years being like, we're not supposed to be in this position. We're not supposed to be bad. It's our birthright to be good. We just need to get the right management in. We just need to get the right ownership in. We'll get back there. And then last year was, holy shit, we're about to lose everything. Because they were going to go, if they were going to go down to the championship, and keep in mind, they still had and still have to this day one of the highest payrolls in the league, which that's a real problem. If you get knocked out of the Premier League, you lose the TV money. And if you are, you know, if you are tied to a bunch of big money contracts, you're all of a sudden in serious financial trouble. So there was a chance that they could get knocked down and wouldn't necessarily come back up anytime soon. It's happened before. So it was a really, really, really big fucking deal that in the second to last game of the season, they beat Crystal Palace at home on a like 86th minute header that secured their place in the Premier League for the next year. I mean, the fans charged the field, and unlike in American sports where when the fans charge the field, the players are immediately escorted out, the players just stayed there with them and they all sort of celebrated and danced and sang for like 45 minutes straight. There were blue flares everywhere. Like, it was beautiful. It was like they won the championship by securing 16th place. So this year, things are even worse. They currently are in 19th place. They're actually tied on points with the team that's in 20th place and ahead of them only on goal differential. So again, if you finish 18th, 19th, or 20th, you are out of there. And the reason why they got in this position, and this goes into why they're such a fascinating clown show train wreck of a professional organization. They got there, of course, because of bad ownership. They were bought 7 or 8 years ago by a guy named Farhad Moshiri, who's an Iranian accountant. You may be wondering, how does an accountant get the billions of dollars required to buy the 19th richest soccer club in the world? Well, he obviously doesn't have that money, but he is personal business partners with a guy named Alexei Usmanov, who's an Uzbeki oligarch who's incredibly close to Vladimir Putin. And essentially, Alexei Usmanov used to be a minority owner of Arsenal. And the open secret is that he's the guy that wanted to buy Everton, but the Premier League didn't let him because he was too shady of a figure. So Moshiri bought it with Usmanov's money. And for years, even though Usmanov was not officially the owner, he kind of was the de facto owner, to the point that, up until last year, up until the Ukrainian invasion, if you were watching a game at Everton, you would have seen the stadium blanketed with ads for a company called USM. Brian, have you ever heard of a company called USM? Have you ever bought anything from USM?
Well, I can't tell you on the second hand, but no, I have not.
No, you have not. That's because it's not a public-facing company that sells any products at all. USM was simply Usmanov's personal holding company. It's literally just the legal entity that held like his shares in nickel mines in Kyrgyzstan and things like that. And yet they were the primary public-facing sponsor of Everton for the sole reason that they were using it as a shady way to funnel more money into the club. So he was this de facto owner. He got sanctioned by the US and UK government. So Everton lost all of their financial backing. And they now find themselves in 19th place. So they lost last week. They lost last week to the team that's chasing them in 20th place, Southampton. Absolutely brutal, horrible home loss. The board of directors was not there because they announced before the game that they had received threats, credible threats of violence. And to prove it, they said that actually in a home game the week before, the CEO was put in a headlock by a fan. So they didn't show up. The fans had planned a protest, by the way. In American sports, when a team sucks and when management's awful, we just stop going to the games. In England, they fucking protest the shit out of management. So they had planned a sit-in after the game. The board announced that they couldn't show up because of credible threats and that the CEO had been put in a headlock by a fan 2 weeks before. All game, as they just went down the shitter and lost to this team that was chasing them, the camera kept panning to the empty board seats in an otherwise full Goodison Park. And it turns out, as has been announced by Liverpool police subsequently, it seems like there may not have actually been any credible threats. And it seems like the headlock story was completely made up. And now the board is just throwing their own fans under the bus. And at the same week that that story about them potentially lying about threats against their safety was released, another story came out that Usmanov, after being sanctioned by the UK and the US, was still sitting in on meetings and interviews with potential managerial candidates last year. Because last year when they were in the relegation battle, they obviously hired a new manager to pull them out of it. So apparently he was sitting in on those meetings and telling the managerial candidates that he was the real owner of the team. So this is a complete disaster. And it sucks because I have really, really fallen in love with soccer and I've fallen in love with this team and they're going to go down. And they're not going to come back up for a while. Now, here's the thing I got to tell you, Brian. I decided to become an Everton fan in November 2020. You want to take a guess why I decided then and at that time to become an Everton fan?
I have a very, very good idea. It was November. Where does Everton play, Dan?
There you go. It was November 2020. The baseball season had ended. I've talked before about how I don't really follow football. I do follow the NBA, but the NBA was in their COVID break and they were 2 months away from starting. So I said, all right, if I'm going to dive in to English soccer, I'm going to do it now. I'm really going to try this. And I chose Everton in November 2020 because Mookie Betts had just won the World Series with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And John Henry owns Liverpool Football Club, who are the chief rivals of Everton. So, Brian Joyner, the Mookie Betts trade has now completely ruined my fan viewing experience for my two favorite teams.
The man can do no wrong.
I would have been, if it weren't for the Mookie Betts trade, I would be cheering for Tottenham right now, probably. They're the other hipster pick.
Of course they are. Everton is a deeper hipster pick.
Yes.
Tottenham is like the classic hipster pick.
Tottenham and Everton are basically like they're the two big teams in England who aren't consistently at the very top of the league, which is why they're the hipster pick. So if you want to you know, if you want to root for a team that you think has a chance of success, but you're not jumping on the bandwagon, you pick one of those two teams. Boy, did I pick the wrong one. So John Henry, you got me, man. You got me in two different sports.
Liverpool won the Champions League in the interim as well.
Yep, they sure did.
I have lots of friends who are really into soccer, and the first team I was attempted to be made a fan of was Arsenal by a friend. And I don't hate them like everyone else does, but their own fans typically hate them. Not this year, but.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't jump on with them now. They're leading the league at the moment. They're still not the betting favorites to win the league because City is so good, but they are leading the league. So if you're going to jump in now, you've lost your Arsenal window. You had a chance a couple of years ago when they were.
The Spurs window is always open, but it's just too much for me. It's too hipster. The only team that's ever grabbed my imagination, and it's a weird one, especially given how they played, was Atletico Madrid. This is like 5 years ago. I still have their jersey, and
they are like the shithouse team of Europe right now. Meaning like they play with like loads of shithousery.
Yeah, they were even then they were the team where Barca and Real were getting 5 goals a game at peak ish Ronaldo Messi, and then they'd play Atleti and it'd be 0-0 or 1-0. Their whole game was they had possession like a quarter of the time. It was all counterattack.
Yeah, yeah.
And for whatever reason, this is when my daughter was young and I had one child, so it was just me and the child. So I couldn't ever pick. No British team ever sort of just grabbed me by itself. And I just felt like I missed out on the. I've had no compelling reason to pick any British team over the other.
Yeah, fair enough.
And then Spanish team, Real's out. It's not happening. Fascists, not happening. And Barca, this was Neymar, Suarez, Messi, Barca. I'm like, okay, I could become a Barca fan. What does that even mean? They were ubiquitous. So I was like, let's try Atleti. And they had Griezmann, and I really liked it from the beginning. And then their kits have these red and white stripes.
Yeah.
And they're sometimes called the mattress makers, because the reason they have red and white stripes, and I think they took this from FC Bilbao, but this is like 100 years ago, was when they started, the cheapest fabric was mattress fabric, and it had red and white stripes. So that's why they used that as their jersey material. It was the cheapest stuff they could get. So as a result, they are sometimes, from what I understand, called the mattress makers. And I still have that jersey and I still wear it, but I don't really watch as much. The funny thing you were talking about Everton is having gotten really into F1, there's a team called Williams that in the 80s they were Williams McLaren, and they were a mom and pop shop, and they still are. And they dominated F1, and they still exist now, but they are like Everton right now. Mm-hmm. But in it for a different reason. It's not like an oligarch who's running a money laundering operation and then just being heavy about it and just ruining the whole thing. This is more the F1 scaled up to the point where a mom and pop team cannot compete with the resources of Mercedes or Ferrari or oddly Red Bull, which until this year, Red Bull never made its own engines, because Red Bull, which is the dominant team, at least was this year in F1, is an energy drink.
It sure is.
It is not a car manufacturer. So that's been interesting to learn about how that works. But the way you talked about Everton reminds me a lot of Williams. They're still around, but it's very sad. It's just very... it's anytime they have a good driver, that driver is on the second there's an opening on the top team. They're like a farm team, but they're like if the Woo Sox were playing alongside the Dodgers. It's rough.
If you're looking for a team, and if you don't want to go England, and if you want to be super hipster about it, I've got a pick for you.
Lay it on me.
Union Berlin, who were leading the Bundesliga before the World Cup for a string. They've fallen back into fifth place now. They are super underdogs. But the reason why I think you would like them in particular is Union Berlin has never been big. They've always been small. Their main rivals, Berliner FC, who were their main rivals throughout the Soviet era, Berliner FC were directly controlled by the Stasi. That's not to say that every fan of Berliner FC was a Stasi sympathizer, but if you were against the state in East Germany, Union Berlin was your team. And they've really embraced that ethos still to this day. And actually German clubs in general, and I'll tie this into Red Bull. German clubs have this cool thing where it's required by law that the clubs have to be owned at least 50.1% by the fans themselves. So they can never be taken over and destroyed by an oligarch or by a billionaire. The fans have to own the teams. So that's a cool thing about German soccer in general. The exception to that is RB Leipzig, Red Bull Leipzig. I don't know why, but for some reason, maybe Germany passed the law after Red Bull bought Leipzig and turned them into a powerhouse. And so people in Germany hate Red Bull Leipzig because it just goes, it's so much against the ethos of the German soccer culture for this corporate owned team. And they're flourishing, obviously. They're not as good as Bayern. But they are flourishing in their regular, they make regular appearances in the Champions League now. And so if you went with Union Berlin, who does have an American on the team, although one who wasn't on the World Cup squad, Jordan Pefock, and he was also born and raised in France, but he's in the American player pool for the U.S. men's national team. He was one of their leading scorers earlier in the year. So going with Germany in general would be a massive hipster pick. And then going with Union Berlin would be just like hipster on top of hipster for you.
You sold me. I mean, the labor stuff sold me. I do have to say I was previously partial to Dortmund.
Oh, shit. Sorry. One thing. I forgot to mention this. Keaton is a Bayern Munich fan.
Of course, which is just the worst.
Yeah. So
you'd be a Man City fan.
Yeah, I know.
Be a Yankees fan.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's great. The other team, this is not a hipster pick at all, but I get the sense they're a whole lot of fun to root for is Roma.
Well, Mourinho is, yes, the Mourinho experience.
Yeah, but I mean, how long, there's a clock on that at all times.
Yeah, and that actually is kind of a hipster pick because even though, they're one of the biggest, best supported teams in Italy, and they obviously play in Rome, but they are not one of the most historically successful teams in Italy. Right. Roma would be like the Tottenham Everton pick of Italy. Basically, it's like you're picking a team that has a chance to be very good, but you're not jumping on a bandwagon.
And then there's Juventus, and just the name is amazing.
Yes. Yeah.
We used to call them Juventu.
I think I used to call them Juventus because I didn't know. Because growing up in like the late 90s, you would maybe come across the names of these soccer teams, but you didn't know how to pronounce them. I definitely called Real Madrid Real Madrid. I definitely called them that. And I think I called Juventus because I didn't know any better. It was another time. It was another planet. We didn't know what these teams were actually called.
You know what the other benefit of Union Berlin is? That you could just go to Berlin, which is from what I have never been. What I understand, it's phenomenal. And then you can see the game because you are in Berlin.
Yeah. I would say, I've never been to Germany at all. I think it's probably Germany might make my top five countries that I haven't been to that I want to visit. It'd be like, it would be on the edge.
Be like if a British fan were picking this. Actually, this ties into a story. I was in Australia when I was 26 or so, and we went snorkeling, and this Australian guy who was about my age was like, yeah, I've always wanted to go to America and see a football game. I'm like, cool. He's like, yeah, I love the Bengals helmets. I want to go to Cincinnati to see a football game. And I was kind of like, and this is, you know, the Bengals. This is, we're still talking. And yeah. This is pretty
good. And also Cincinnati.
Yeah.
you're not going to send a tourist to Cincinnati, although it is like one of our most German cities. So
and maybe I told him, not a lot of people have that dream. But it would be like a fan picking, like, I want to go see a Packers game. Like, what the, do you? Yeah. Do yeah. you?
Have you ever been to Cincinnati?
I've not been to Cincinnati. I have been to Green Bay.
There is one great neighborhood in Cincinnati, and it's both a legitimately great and fun neighborhood to be in, but it also has the single best name of any urban neighborhood in America. Over the Rhine. That's the name of the neighborhood. Where do you live? I live in Over the Rhine. But other than that, Cincinnati. I the last time I went to Cincinnati, which was like 2017 probably. we got in a cab at the airport, and we were still living in New York at the time, and so the taxi driver picks us up and like, oh, where are you coming from? I'm like, oh, just flew in from New York. And I immediately got the 9/11.
It's always 9/11.
9/11. Like, A, I was in high school in southeastern Massachusetts when it happened, and B, like, there's a lot more to New York than 9/11, I would say. But you go to
always 9/11 somewhere. Yeah. I've actually flown through Cincinnati. The airport's in Kentucky, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, it is. You're right. Yeah.
But I have been to Green Bay, not during football season, during college road trip season. Mm-hmm. For the scavenger hunt. So
you did a scavenger hunt that took you to Green Bay? That's
the one fun thing that the University of Chicago is known for at all is they have a scavenger hunt every spring where there's a list you get that's like 400 items. You get it at like Thursday at 5 or something. By the scavenger hunt committee, which I was on my senior year. So like I got to create the list. And within the list.
Is this like that movie, that really bad movie? What's it called?
The University of Chicago is in general like a horror movie. But yes.
All right, continue. I'll think of it. It's a really bad teen movie where the guy has to like do a bunch of like, forget it. Never mind. Continue.
So you get this giant list and there will be like wordplay items. There'll be anything you can think of that these, myself notwithstanding, like geniuses decided was funny to get or whatever. But then within that list, there'll be items in no discernible order. It's not separated out. You have to figure it out. Items that pertain to a road trip that needs to be completed by the time judging starts Sunday at like 5. It's like a 72-hour thing. And you need to suss out where you need to go and just like hit the road immediately. So I did the road trip as a participant twice. And the first year it went to New Orleans and back again in 72 hours. You got to stop all
How
the
long
way.
Does had, that take?
We had to go to Ole Miss to do something. We had to go to Memphis to do something. We had to get a password from a waiter in New Orleans. We had to do a bunch of stuff in New Orleans and we came back. Serial numbers of like a napkin holder. And then the second time I did it, we went in a circle that went through Toronto. This is before you needed a passport to go across the thing. So you just go, right? So to Toronto and then up through Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, which is where Bobby Orr is from. I'm sorry, he's from Sudbury, Ontario, but you come back to America.
He's from is it Sudbury?
It's Sudbury. You go up and around the Great Lakes, basically, and then you come down through Sault Ste. Marie, and one of the items, and then you
Parry Sound. I know.
Okay, okay. Yeah. It's very close.
Maybe that's in Sudbury. Very close. I don't know Canada, but
no, you're right. You're right. It is Parry Sound. That but you come down. The Canada heads are screaming at us.
They really
are. You come down through Green Bay. And one of the items was you had to, and this was in March or April, it was cold. You had to take a picture of yourself in each of the five Great Lakes. And I was the one that did it. And then I created the road trip my senior year. And we went through Milwaukee to Minneapolis to Sioux Falls to Omaha and back. Got very, very drunk the last night in Omaha, and it was the night there was a giant, giant White Sox Tigers brawl, just like unbelievably huge brawl. And we were at the bar watching it, and we were in shit. People were talking just because they're like, "Oh, we just came from Chicago. Like, oh, look at this brawl." So,
yeah, that's was this a sanctioned thing?
Yeah, yeah,
it was just like a school sanctioned
student organization that exists to run it every. This thing has been.
I don't understand how this still exists. Oh, let me tell you something.
We won the road trip once. We won the scavenger hunt once, barely, because we were in a dorm that had like seven houses. But one of the houses decided it wanted to field its own team. Fine. Whatever. One of the items on the scavenger hunt list, not for the road trip, was build a working breeder reactor.
I don't know what that means.
An atom splitter.
Okay.
On the lawn of that building where the judging was. And this being the University of Chicago, they managed to do that. And it was worth like it was like worth 10,000 points, whereas other things would be worth like 10 or like
100. That seems fair.
And the only reason they lost, they would have humiliated us because they were the team that decided not to be in our group. Was that their road trip car broke down and they didn't make it back in time. Otherwise, they would have won.
But I think you should still let that team win if they successfully.
No, because
I didn't even know what the word was, and they built it on a lawn.
It would be like if Quebec was trying to face off with the rest of Canada and nobody really liked them and they didn't want to be part of it. Mm-hmm. The rest of Canada isn't going to be if they win, like, say, a hockey. Oh, well, you did really well. Now, fuck you. You're better than us. You're not better than us. That's the thing. Your resources, you know, it's just, anyhow, it was all a good time. And that was the only fun thing we did in college outside of create the newspaper late at night.
Yeah, that does sound fun. I can't believe it still exists in like today's like litigation culture that's an actual sanctioned activity.
I think it blows my mind. I think the best item. And this wasn't mine that somebody created and nobody got. But one of the best items was the express written consent of Major League Baseball.
that would be amazing.
That's great. The coolest one that happened was there's a Shakespeare professor named David Bevington, who was it's the University of Chicago. He's one of the guys. And one of the items was get a tenured professor, and it could have been anyone, to read the lyrics to NWA's Find 'Em, Fuck 'Em, and Flee at the judge. Right.
Yeah, that, I mean, you know.
So some people did that, and a lot of people censored the language. Yeah. He did not. And he did it very theatrically.
Well,
and
yeah.
All I remember is he pointed a finger at everyone, and I don't remember anything. He pointed at all of us. He said, "All you mark ass hoes." I just remember that.
Yeah. That doesn't actually sound like I can't envision a single English professor I ever had in college who wouldn't do that. That one actually sounds pretty easy to me.
Do you forget that the University of Chicago, there's a 10-inch minimum stick needs to be inserted into your ass for you to be there.
Gotcha.
And Only when you leave can it be removed. So that's enough about that.
The movie, just real quick, the movie I was thinking of, Dirty Deeds, 2005. Does that ring a bell?
No.
With Lacey Chabert and Milo Ventimiglia.
That is so 2005. It's unbelievable.
According to a high school's lore, the Dirty Deeds are a daunting list of dares almost no student has ever completed. To win the student body's respect and get noticed by his crush Meg, portrayed by Lacey Chabert, senior Zach is determined to finish the list in the allotted 24-hour period. That got 7% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's wonderful. I think this was a good segment. I think that
was that our home and home, or do you still have one?
I think we've covered enough for this
one. I think we probably have. Yeah. No, that was fascinating.
Yeah, we can instead of home and home, we can just say, you know, we're going to do a little freestyle. Maybe it won't be a half an hour. I mean, it usually probably will be, but at the end.
How long has this been going on so far? Oh, 80 minutes approaching. Okay.
Yeah, it's not so bad.
No,
it's not but it is time to get to my enemy of the week, which I'm going to dovetail with my recommendation.
Okay. So you're not going to, I assumed you were just going to reach back into someone who you really hated from college for this, but okay.
No, but we already talked about him plenty. I don't want to talk about him any more than necessary. It's Lazy Brian, because my recommendation, and I did this for years, and then COVID happened and I haven't done it for years, and I just started again, and is, look, everyone has their own health and well-being exercise regimen that works for them, their gym, they run, whatever. Mine is rock climbing.
Oh, interesting. Indoor
rock climbing. It's the thing that works for me, and I just haven't done it for many reasons. There was a pandemic. I got divorced. I got fat, blah, 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 blah. Finally started going again and paying attention to it, and immediately remember why I loved it so much before. And I think I'm back in it for the long haul. So that's my recommendation.
Okay. I have questions for you. I have several questions for you.
Go for it.
One, can a six-year-old do this? Because my wife and I were just trying. We were just like Googling ways to occupy our time in the middle of the winter. And she saw like a kid's rock climbing place and suggested it. And I was like, I don't know if our kid can do it.
Well, let me
tell obviously, you. I guess this is designed for kids. It's not what you're doing, but.
Well, but I was a member and I suspended my membership for a while and it kicked back in December and I didn't stop them. And I was like, oh, maybe it'll force me to go. And it didn't. It was my daughter who's 7 and my son who's 5 who decided on their own they wanted to go last Saturday. Mm-hmm. And immediately it was like the seal had been broken and I was back. Kids are very good at this. And some kids are incredible at this. Some kids are much better than me. Some kids are just spider monkeys, but they all want to climb.
We even thought about like maybe that's what we should do for his birthday party.
It's amazing. Kids, we went on a Saturday morning. I usually go weekdays around 11 a.m. where there's nobody there. Saturday mornings, it's going to be packed with kids. It's a great kids activity.
All right. So, question number two. Do you need to be able to do a pull-up to do this activity? Because that might be a problem for me.
Well, no, there's a distinction. I do bouldering more than I do rope climbing. The only difference being that the bouldering wall is sufficiently
that's the one with
low like enough that you could jump from that you could jump from the top onto the pad without having to worry about fall.
Gotcha. Okay.
Whereas the rope, you go to the top of the warehouse that we're in, and then you don't want to jump from there. Mm-hmm. And the simplest versions will, it's a really nice activity, especially when you're starting or even just really at any time, because your progress is so evident from visit to visit that if you don't need to do a pull up, but if you just go a few times, you'll be able to do them.
Interesting.
It's full body strength. For me, the reason I love it, the reason it's good for me, is that this is the only reason I will stretch. I just know that about myself.
Stretching is so goddamn hard, isn't it? Like, it feels good to do. I know I need to do it, but actually taking the time to stretch is like fucking impossible.
For me, the climbing gym is a chicken and egg thing because I need, it's all the same activity because it is, you are, a lot of what you're doing is stretching. And, you know, if you're doing the rock climbing correctly, you're moving your weight and using core strength to minimize the amount of pressure you're putting on any one area, to keep things fluid. But for me, the climbing, I climb so that I can loosen up to stretch, so that I can stretch to climb. And it just, it sort of, so I will stretch in between. I try to do a route every like 3 or 4 minutes when I'm there, but I'll stop. It's just a really, it's a great environment. I recommend it.
Okay. Question number three, have you ever done this outside, or are you just doing the fake American Gladiators style rock climbing?
So one thing that you'll notice once you start rock climbing is you see anyone holding on to something in a movie, you're like, if you don't do that all the time, you're going to fall immediately.
Right.
When I was really into rock climbing before, I didn't go search out outdoor climbing, but if I was on a hike and saw something that was just easy to, you just start thinking, it's like Tetris, whereas if you play a lot of Tetris, you start seeing the Tetris pieces. When I was climbing a ton, I'd see a tree and I'm like, how do I do that? So I, like the tree in the front yard I had at the time, I climbed that and start applying that to different, like kids' playgrounds. You suddenly want to, I want to get to the top without using the stairs, and I want to climb on the outside. So it really builds upon itself. And as I was saying, anyone who tries it, and if you stick with it through like a month, first thing that's going to happen is your tendons and your forearms are just going to hurt like hell. But that will happen once. It's like growing adult teeth, because once I went through that one strengthening, it's been like 3 years since I've climbed regularly, but I'm still strong enough to do it in my tendons. It just can happen. You sort of like solidify it, and then after that it's just your muscles that hurt, and they hurt a lot.
Does that help your typing and or longhand writing?
It doesn't help my writing in the sense that it makes me very at ease and not anxious. And
you need to be anxious, right? No, I meant literally physically, like, because this is a problem I'm having now. I frequently do write longhand, almost never for the site. But if I'm trying to write fiction or something, I frequently do longhand. But I have an awful, awful grip on the pen, and it's getting bad and really starting to hurt. And I'm coming to grips with the fact that I actually like need to completely change the way I hold a pen, or else I'm not going to be able to write for a long time. So I'm wondering, like, does it literally make my hand stronger for those?
Yes. Your hands will be shockingly strong.
Interesting.
I
might give this a shot.
That you just got to stick with it. But there, so a lot of the, some of the climbs, especially in bouldering, will be your upper body strength. So you're sort of pulling yourself up, maybe you're inverted, and those might be easier for you. But then there are other ones that'll be close to the wall, won't be inverted, but the hold will be like maybe sometimes like a centimeter. And so your hands won't be strong enough at the start to do them, but then they will gradually, you will just grab it and you realize that you're grabbing like something as thin as a, just like a basic wallet, and you're holding on and it's great. Your hands will get.
You're really good at holding wallets now.
I lose my wallet all the time, but I'm good at holding holds on the wall. Do you have any recommendations?
I do. I'm going to recommend a movie. I feel like movies are back these days. I don't know if that's a universal feeling or not, but I feel like for years, everyone's just like TV, streaming TV.
The TV glut seems to be
It's real bad now.
Yeah.
It's real bad. Like, I'm at the point where, you know, just to the show of the moment, I don't like, did you watch the first episode of The Last of Us on HBO?
I don't have HBO at the moment.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, I watched it last week and I'm like, yeah, sure. It's fine. And, you know, 10 years ago, I would have been like, well, this is amazing. We are in this for the long haul. For this one, I'm just like, I don't need this in my life. There's just too many. There's just too many. And if the first episode isn't like amazing, if the first episode doesn't plainly state and make clear like why I need it in my life, I don't have the attention span to.
People say Andor is the best Star Wars product ever created. And I've watched a bunch of them and I'm just like, I wish I felt that way, guys. I just don't have it. I just don't have it.
That's interesting that you said that, because I did try that. So confession time for me, I've only seen one Star Wars movie.
Which one?
The original.
Good.
Whatever that's the one best that one. One is. So that's the only one I've ever seen in my life. But I did see, like, I saw a bunch of people saying, like, Andor's the best show of the year. And so I tried it and I watched the first episode and I'm like, okay, yeah. I'm like, it's fine, but I don't need this. And so I kind of feel like I've been more into movies now, because it's okay if a movie's not great, because you're just sitting down for one night with it anyway. So I've been really watching a ton of movies lately I try to watch the Best Picture nominees every year. That was, I don't know if, one of the things when my wife and I had our first kid, that was one of the things I told her that I wanted to do going forward, because I was so afraid of just becoming totally detached from culture. I don't know if your parents were like this, but in the 18 years that I lived with my parents saw three movies, not including like Disney movies that they saw with us. They saw three movies. They saw Titanic, they saw Forrest Gump, and they saw Mr. Holland's Opus. I'm talking like going to the movie theater, watching. That's it. My parents were so detached from culture. And so when we were having a kid, I told my wife, like, I didn't want to do that. And one of our strategies to avoiding that was we were going to be like, let's make sure we watch the Best Picture nominees every year, which we haven't, but mostly because, you know, you look at the nominees and you're like, well, I don't need to see that piece of crap.
Twice as many as there used to be.
And there are twice as many. Yep. But we are attempting it this year. So a couple nights ago, I did watch The Banshees of Inisherin. That movie is good as shit if you haven't watched that yet. It is so goddamn good. Nothing happens in it. The stakes are so low. The stakes are very high for one person in particular. And I guess I should say, like, nothing happens until something really happens. But the thing that happens only affects, like, this one guy. The stakes are not universal at all. There's only like six people in the whole movie. There's only like two sets in the whole movie. But it is so goddamn good. Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson are just amazing. Every scene is gripping because of how good they are. It's funny. It's funny. It's strange. Definitely give it a watch if you haven't seen it yet.
Why would you think that I would like a funny and strange movie where nothing happens on a windswept island in the winter? What makes you think I, of all people, would like that? No, I really want to see that. I actually wanted to see it in the theater, but it was not showing anywhere near me. It's like,
I suppose it is worth seeing in the theater just because there is a lot of pretty Ireland. But, you know, it's not.
But I wanted to do it to make it special, honestly.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Seriously, like, there's some movies like I haven't seen Avatar, but if I did, I would want to see it in the theater, but not for the same reason. I'd want to see Banshees. I just want to see it because everyone has had your reaction. I mean, I have seen the clip where Colin Farrell's yelling at Brendan Gleeson, says Bear Fairven is for Beethoven. And
I do recommend watching with subtitles. Because those accents are thick as fuck. They really, really are.
From what I can tell, he's plainly going to win Best Actor at the Academy Awards, right?
I haven't looked at the odds. Are you saying Farrell or Gleeson? Because I'm not even Farrell. Sure which. Farrell is Gleeson. And so Gleeson.
Because Farrell won the Golden Globe. Yeah. So, you know.
Did he? Yeah. All right. And so also. Yes, he is in. He is in like every single scene bar one. And carries those, and obviously carries the whole movie. So yeah, I guess if you're in every single scene and the movie is nominated for Best Picture, then how are you not the Best Actor by default?
And he has become a, like, really a beloved guy. And this was,
he's awesome. You know, I've always been a huge Colin Farrell guy.
And he, I don't know, the Golden Glove speech, like, he's sober. He's so gracious. And he, so Ana de Armas gave him the award. And he, before his speech, he said, I want to thank you. And I want to tell you about this moment in Blonde. It was such an amazing performance. This is his speech.
Yeah.
And he's talking to her. And she's off to the side. And he's just like, I can't thank you enough. And it was really heartwarming. All right.
He's great. And I also love, and he's great. And it's great that he's allowed to be Irish in this movie. Because the one thing, like Colin Farrell, I don't think has ever been good at hiding that accent. And that's been my one problem, whether it's like Phone Booth, which, God, that movie sucked. But Phone Booth, or that other movie he did with Al Pacino where he was like a spy, The Recruit. You ever see The Recruit?
No.
Oh, that's actually, you know what? Go watch The Recruit. That's a great like turn. I don't know why that movie kind of got lost. Colin Farrell and Al Pacino in like a genuinely gripping spy thriller. That's good. But in all those movies, he's so bad at hiding his accent. And every time I've ever watched a Colin Farrell movie, I've been like, they should have just added one quick line at the beginning explaining, like, here's this guy, Derek. He's from Ireland, but he's here now. Just so, like,
you know what movie does that amazingly? Is National Treasure, where Diane Kruger works at the archives and she's American. And they're like, she starts speaking and Nicolas Cage's character goes, Pennsylvania, German country. It's like, that's it. And that's it. And she's like, yes. And it's just like, that was it. It's like, okay. It's probably not the accent anyway, but at least you addressed it.
Yeah. I don't think the Amish have German accents anymore,
but they just threw it in there as a result. Like, we want Diane Kruger because she's a very attractive person. Let's get her in there.
We need to explain. That's really funny. I've never seen that movie. That's really funny. And that's what needed to be done in every one of Colin Farrell's movies.
See National Treasure also. That is it for our free-flowing conversations.
All right. We have 3 minutes to get to 90 minutes.
Okay.
Are you sure you want to stop right here?
Yeah. Let those people have that time back.
Okay.
Reclaim your time. All right. Reclaim your time, people. Soon there will be that. The irony of this conversation, and maybe we'll drag it out 3 minutes, is that the second spring training starts, the smallest things are going to be fodder for the biggest discussions. Mm-hmm. Will they be justified? Probably not. But right now, we wait for that day. Dan, enjoy your beautiful snowy scenery up in Boston.
Hope you get some soon.
Yeah, me too.
All right, take care.